Hello.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you, Sarah?
Good. I'm Sarah Posner. I'm Associate Editor at Religion Dispatches, and I'm here with Michael Brendan Daugherty of the American Conservative.
Yeah.
Do you want to give yourself any more of an introduction than that?
No, just a contributing editor at the American Conservative.
Great. Well, and speaking of the American Conservative, you have a new piece coming out in the May issue about the Tea Party, the conservative movement, and the religious right.
Right.
So why don't you give us a little bit of a summary of that, and then we can talk about it.
Sure. In the last presidential election in 2008, there was this metaphor going around about the Republican coalition. And it was said that the Republican coalition was held up by a three-legged stool of social conservatism, national defense conservatism, and economic conservatism. And this is roughly also kind of meant to signal a division of labor. So religious people work on the social issues, libertarians or Wall Streeters work on economic issues, and neoconservatives work on foreign policy issues. And what I tried to point out was that actually the religious right, as we call them, is the base of all three legs of that stool, that they are the demographic group most enthusiastic for and committed to and electorally most important on all three issues. And if you talk to religious right leaders from Richard Land all the way to John Hagee, their feelings on economic and foreign policy issues are just as strong as anything else. And if you really scratch the surface of the Tea Party, and you've definitely done this, and I think I'm catching up, is that you know, the Tea Party isn't this new libertarian phenomenon. I mean,
right.
I say it's the religious right in tricorn hats talking about taxes. And, you know, if you look to the numbers, it's pretty stunning. You know, Pew's done some surveys.
Well, the first one was the Public Religion Research Institute did a survey back in 2010 before the election, and then Pew did a survey after the election that came out in February, and they both pretty much showed the same thing.
Right. Right, which is that, you know, if you poll Tea Party members, they oppose, you know, they favor banning abortion at the same rate as the religious right,
and actually favor it at higher rates than Republicans as a whole.
Yeah, it's 17% higher than the average voter. You know, and white evangelical Protestants were found to agree with the Tea Party roughly five times, you know, more than the average voter.
And not just agree with the Tea Party, but form the Tea Party activist base.
Right.
So when you find, and I have just, those polls resonated with me, and I don't want to sound like, you know, oh yeah, the poll proved that I was right. I'm not saying that at all. But anecdotally, in my reporting, when I would cover Tea Party events or religious right events, I would find that intersection, and it wasn't just shared ideology or shared beliefs on certain issues. It was that activists, there were shared activists. You would find activists who were, you know, had originally been trained with religious right organizations to be political activists, and then they're discovering the Tea Party. So that it was an overlap of ideas, and it was also an overlap of ground troops, for lack of a better word.
Right. And, you know, the other thing I found, you know, if you go back, I mean, and this is just still talking about the numbers, if you go back to 2006, white evangelical Protestants were the absolutely most loyal group to the Republican Party. If you look in 2006, when the Bush presidency was at its nadir, you know, the Iraq War was going especially bad at that time. Independents, moderates were all just leaving the Republican Party in droves, and gave us a Democratic majority, short-lived. But they gave us a Democratic majority. But if you pulled evangelical Protestants, 59% of them reported that they were that they believe Republicans were doing a good or very good job at representing the party's traditional values.
And they're also, according to some other polling, more likely than any other religious demographic to watch Fox News.
Right. And you just find, you know, if you talk to, you know, these names might be unfamiliar to Blogging Heads viewers, but if you talk to someone like Jordan Sekulow, mm-hmm. son of Jay Sekulow of right. the American Center for Law and Justice, you know, he helps spearhead efforts about, like, Christian leaders for a nuclear-free Iran. You know, and people tend not to think of white evangelical religious right voters as having particularly strong foreign policy views. You know, they tend to just associate them with abortion or...
Well, that's interesting. That was actually something that I wanted to ask you about, mm-hmm. about your reporting on that piece, because I think that there's sort of two competing or two adversarial wings within the conservative movement on foreign policy, the non-interventionists
right.
and the interventionists. And for because a lot of evangelicals are also Christian Zionists, they're very much interventionist in terms of especially Middle East policy.
Right.
And I think that the Coalition for the Nuclear Free Iran, despite the use of the term nuclear free something, they're not a bunch of anti
right.
peace activists.
Right.
They very much think that they
right. no,
just
exactly
lest
right.
there be any confusion about that. But they're opposed to the possibility of the Iranian regime having a nuclear weapon,
mm-hmm.
As, you know, are other people too.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of people in that coalition, I think, would be fairly characterized as Christian Zionists whose principal interest in that movement, in the anti-Iran nukes movement, is not the United States as much as it is Israel.
Right. There's definitely a lot of that. And what was interesting was talking to someone like Jordan Sekulow, who I think has a Jewish grandparent.
Well, his father converted to Christianity. His father grew up Jewish.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Thank you for that. He's not theologically, he doesn't fit in with what you'd call colloquially the left behind style. He's not a what you'd call a premillennial dispensationalist.
Right. Can we just, I just wanted to make sure that we explained who he was. His father, Jay Sekulow, is the head of the American Center for Law and Justice, which is the legal organization that Pat Robertson founded as a Christian counterweight to the ACLU.
Right. And the ACLJ is actually active in a number of countries. I mean, they have offices in France.
Including Israel.
What?
Including Israel.
Israel. They have it's actually amazing the amount of growth they've had as an organization. But you talk to him, and he talks about, you know, there's kind of a continuum of affinity among evangelicals with Israel. So there's the ones that have a straight theological affinity that is based on what they view as biblical prophecy. And then there,
right.
it runs the gamut. There are others who just have an affinity with Israel as, you know, it's not as hardcore. It's still based on some of the same verses, you know, those who bless you will be blessed, et cetera.
Right, right. I mean, I think they all share the quote-unquote love for Israel, but maybe for a greater variety of reasons than people think, because on the one hand you have like a John Hagee who spends
right.
a lot of time, or a Tim LaHaye who spent a lot of time talking about the end times and what's going
right.
to happen in as prophesied in the Bible. Although, go ahead and finish your thought about Sekulow and where he falls in that spectrum, because I...
Well, it's interesting, you know, so he's not a premillennial dispensationalist, although he actually
Which Hagee is, just so that, yeah.
Yeah, they're
yeah.
Support. And he just... What was interesting about his comments on foreign policy was he said that, you know, to distinguish himself from, say, a neoconservative... you know, he said, you know, for us, it wasn't, for us, meaning conservative Christians, it wasn't an Ivy League conversion to American exceptionalism. You know, we were already there trying to restore that notion.
Was he taking a swipe at somebody in particular with that statement?
No, it was just something it was just something I'd put to him, you know, and asked, you know, well, what's the difference? What's the cash out? And, you know, because it's interesting, I mean, my magazine has gone to a lot of lengths to examine neoconservatism as an ideology, its history, you know, its contours, its main players, etc. But if you look at, you know, neoconservatives, when they have a foreign policy confab at AEI, they barely fill up you know, a side room in that building. When John Hagee comes to Washington, he brings 5,000 people and fills up a convention center.
But also can bring the neoconservatives with him.
Right. Well, that's the thing, too, is that, you know, I was trying to get at that tension, is that we tend to think of, and then on the other hand, though, it's not, you know, Baptist pastors are not filling in high-level offices at the Pentagon. You know, so I did ask some of them about, you know, well, are you providing the energy for a policy that's ultimately determined by a Dick Cheney or a Paul Wolfowitz? And they said, well, you know, there's a distinction, but maybe there's not in the cash out a big difference. And I thought that was telling, that, you know, that felt like, well, we come
in the cash out, meaning in how the policy ultimately comes out.
Right. So that, oh, well, we come to the same policy, but we come to it from different worlds or different ways.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that when you go back, if you go back and you look at support from people like Hagee for the Iraq War, for example, it definitely was coming at it from a different perspective than the straight neocons were.
Right.
But from say the Bush administration's perspective, what difference did it make? Right?
Right.
Because they would have the support, so the neoconservatives were sort of the inside the beltway people creating the strategy. But because they had the support of, you know, the grassroots that someone like Hagee or Tim LaHaye or, you know, some of the other popular premillennial dispensationalists could bring, then, you know, it's sort of was a win-win for everybody. I mean, if you are looking at it from their perspective.
And the other thing that was interesting, too, was if you looked at – I talked to Richard Land of
– the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah, and he supports very strongly the President Obama's action in Libya. And I thought that would be an interesting test case, because among conservatives, at least, that I run into, support for the president's intervention in Libya, or NATO's mission there now, was found, it seemed, only among neoconservatives. And, you know, it wasn't just libertarians or traditionally isolationist types that were criticizing that policy. But neoconservatives aren't alone. I mean, Richard Land came out and said that this was the right thing to do. You know, he'd like to see Obama pay attention to some constitutional niceties about a declaration of war or authorization. But he wholeheartedly endorsed it. He used it as a chance to swipe at Clinton for abandoning, for not intervening in Rwanda. And it was interesting to see... It was interesting to see that, you know, I almost want to call Richard Land more mainline compared to a John Hagee, but it's interesting to see this kind of armed humanitarianism view.
I think that that's very common among evangelicals like Land.
Yeah.
And I think that they sort of see themselves as, like you said, that it's a humanitarian sort of thing, standing up to a dictator, America using its military might and its moral might to take on a dictator like Gaddafi. And I think he views it solely from that, or at least, I think that someone like Richard Land is politically smart enough from his perch in Washington to see that that's like a winning sort of, and I don't say winning meaning victorious, I mean winning, like, appealing argument for an evangelical to make. Whereas you still see a lot of the more end times oriented Christian Zionists, and I'm not saying that Land is not a Christian Zionist, I think he probably is, but I think the ones who are sort of more oriented around this biblical prophecy and the end times scenario would try harder to fit the Libya action into that sort of framework.
Right. Right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, because, you know, I talked to others who felt that, you know, on the whole, evangelicals were still reactive on foreign policy, that they didn't have an overarching doctrine that gave them guidance, you know, in each way. You know, they don't have, you know, say, Catholic just war theory, or they don't have, you know, kind of the rigidity and the direction of neoconservatism either. And so they tend to, you know, show one set of instincts, you know, maybe that look isolationist at first, but then once America's involved in a war, they are intensely invested in that outcome.
But how prevalent do you find the non-interventionist point of view? And let's, I guess, talk about it strictly in terms of Israel, since we were talking about the evangelicals and Christian Zionists being so interested in Israel. I think that was it Rand Paul who proposed cutting off aid to Israel, and it was Rand, not Ron.
Right. Well, they both have.
Right. And do you think that that's what that's a big sticking point for them among conservatives? I mean, they do obviously have a pretty large following, each of them, or maybe they have the same following.
Yeah.
But I mean, do you think that that's what prevents them from sort of breaking out of the pack, say, if Ron Paul runs for president again, or Rand Paul?
I think it's an issue. I think Rand has been very cagey on this issue, because if you look at the polling and you just ask about foreign aid, conservatives and the religious right oppose it quite vociferously. And I think what Rand is doing is using it as a little bit of a wedge issue to begin crowbarring some of his base of voters away from interventionism, or a kind of, you know, lockstep approval of whatever Bibi Netanyahu wants American policy to be.
Right. That's someone who's very popular among American evangelicals.
But Rand would never, like, mention Bibi Netanyahu in a kind of nasty way, because he's cagey, and I think he knows what he's doing. And I think he's just putting it out there, and he'll say, yeah, I oppose foreign aid to Israel, but I also oppose foreign aid. You know, we were giving money to bail out Gaddafi's banks a few months before we started bombing their country. So, you know, I think he's using that slowly to try to bring some of his base away from maybe the neoconservatives. But I think his view comes from his libertarianism. And then also, you know, I find non-interventionists, both in the larger conservative movement and among evangelicals or religious right, they're in the position of a very small minority. I mean, they're dissenters, effectively.
I mean, but do you think that's because of the religious makeup of the conservative movement? I mean, do you think that it's because the conservative movement is so propelled by the religious right, or so undergirded by the religious right? Do you think that's why the non-interventionists can't get a strong foothold?
I think there's a ton of reasons why, and some of them have to do with just history. Because if you look at the modern religious right and neoconservatives, they have a very similar history, in the sense of they both began moving into the Republican Party in the 70s and 80s in a big way. For a lot of religious conservatives, Roe v. Wade obviously was a big turning point in their political affinities. And for neoconservatives, it was the counterculture of the left and criticism of Israel. And you see them gradually moving over in the Republican Party in the 80s and being disgusted with the, you know, what they saw as the excesses of the left, of the anti-Vietnam War movement, et cetera. And so I think there's a, you know, a lot of historical forces at play there. And, you know, non-interventionists on the right have, you know, we're living in a cave throughout the Cold War. You know, they just, for all intents and purposes, they didn't exist. And it's just been, a growing faction since the end of the Cold War.
And the Cold War was very motivating for, I mean, I think it's an under, it's not as understood as it should be, but I think that the Cold War was very motivating for the religious right.
Yeah.
Because they viewed communism as, you know, this, you know, antichrist,
yeah.
anti-God force. And that I think explains a lot of their rhetoric around
socialism
the
today.
American left and the imagined socialism of
it's true.
Like
it's funny too, because I've always thought that Glenn Beck's Blackboard was eerily reminiscent of Archbishop Fulton Sheen's Blackboard on his show Life is Worth Living, which aired competing with Amos and Andy back in the 60s.
Oh, I've never seen.
And
are there videos available?
Oh, if you look on YouTube, you can find videos of Fulton Sheen drawing on a blackboard and talking about, you know, what a threat communism is.
Well, I think a lot of people overemphasize Beck's debt to Cleon Skousen because of their shared religious beliefs. They're both Mormon, but I think that Beck owes a debt to a lot of other people from that period as well.
Absolutely.
And I think to focus solely on Skousen, who, you know, yes, was a player and was involved in that a lot of that religiously motivated anti-communism activism, I think that people have overemphasized his debt to Skousen because of the Mormonism.
Right.
Yeah. So, that's that foreign policy aspect of this is really interesting to me, but I wanted to also ask you about the social, quote unquote, social issues. I find that term so kind of odd, but
in the '70s, it meant stuff like busing.
Yeah. I mean, it just doesn't explain what they are, but anyway, I think more bluntly, they're sex and sexuality issues,
yeah.
than social issues. But I think that there was a lot of talk over the past couple of weeks as that the budget showdown between Obama and the House Republicans came to a head, that the Title X funding for family planning and healthcare, a lot of which goes to Planned Parenthood, became sort of like the final stand between Boehner and Obama. And I think there was a lot of discussion of who knew that the Tea Party was interested in these social issues in abortion and contraception
right.
and family planning. What a surprise. But of course it shouldn't be a surprise because for reasons probably you talk about in your piece.
Yeah. I mean, if you have, was it Michelle Goldberg wrote in the American Prospect a while ago when the Tea Party thing was just getting started that, she was noting the similarities between Tea Party and religious right.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, both have their strongholds in the white South, and both arise out of a sense of furious dispossession, a conviction that the country is rightfully theirs and has been usurped by a sinister cosmopolitan elite. They have the same favorite politicians. And if you look, Michelle Bachmann and Jim DeMint are now Tea Party caucus leaders.
Right.
And the obvious rejoinder is, yeah, they're the same people. These are literally the same people.
Right.
Values voters in 2004, which were the big story, they didn't, like, get spirited away in the rapture. That didn't happen yet. So they haven't been replaced by this whole new set of voters. It's the same voters.
And, you know, I think to describe the Tea Party as libertarian, for some of the reasons we're talking about right here, is inaccurate because libertarian suggests, you know, no government intervention in anything. So we've already discussed how the non-interventionists in foreign policy are pretty much crowded out of this movement.
Right.
And, you know, we're talking about people who want the government to be more involved in deciding whether people should be allowed to have access to family planning services or abortion services.
Right,
that's
but let
not
me
a libertarian. I mean, you can call that whatever you want to call it, but I mean, it's not libertarian.
Well, I can catch you on that though, because we know that in the long run, you know, much of the Tea Party would like to see abortion banned. Period.
By the government.
Right, by the
so
government.
That's,
but
right.
in the so, now, and this gives us a mm-hmm. good segue, in the now, they've attacked it on libertarian grounds. Well, why is the federal government giving money to, why is it subsidizing Planned Parenthood?
But I actually think that that was how they sold it as a Tea Party issue and how they sold it as a fiscal issue.
Right.
I mean, obviously, as an actual deficit-reducing issue. It's a non-issue because the amount of money compared to the entire budget is not a huge amount of money.
Right.
But I guess if you're looking to chip away in all these different places, you know, sure, right? But on the other hand, you could also make the argument that not funding family planning for women who don't, you know, otherwise have access to it would create more of a deficit because then they would have more of a dependence on other government services.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if you want to cut off all those government services anyway, then, you know, but I mean, it causes other societal problems to have, you know, more unintended pregnancies, or societal costs, shall we say, not problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that they sold it as a fiscal issue. Like, why is the government paying for this? But for many, many years before this became sort of like the final showdown between Boehner and Obama, Mike Pence, also a Tea Party favorite, has been calling to defund Planned Parenthood. He's been doing that at Values Voters Summits, you know, which is the annual,
yep,
the big annual meeting for religious conservatives and the religious right. He's been calling for defunding Planned Parenthood for years. I mean, I've covered every single Values Voters Summit since they started.
Right.
And that is every year that's a topic, and it's possibly one of the biggest applause lines.
Right. Well, I mean, there's there's three things at work there then, right? So, you know, you sell it as a fiscal issue, and it makes sense to, you know, the some fiscal voters who may not have particularly strong feelings on abortion anyway, but, or on access to family planning services, however you want to put it. But yeah, the energy is drawn from people who just straight out oppose abortion. And the third thing is there's also partisan interest.
But not only oppose abortion, but they oppose, you know, they think Michelle Bachmann last week said something. She wasn't specifically talking about the Planned Parenthood funding, but she was speaking a sort of string of supposed left attacks on what the real America. And one of the things she named was an attack on fertility. So it's almost as if – it's not almost as if – it's that they view that – they view the government providing access to family planning services as sort of un-American. Like, you know, you're depriving us of producing more of Christian soldiers that we can have to keep America strong and enable us to carry out, you know, God's mission of having – this view of what America is.
Right. Well, there's also, there's also, you know, Planned Parenthood's never given money to Michelle Bachmann's re-elections either, you know.
why should they?
Right. But they do give money to Democrats. And
yes. And I do think that it's part and parcel of the attack on organizations like Acorn and unions. And, you know, I think that from a strategy standpoint, sure, they see this as an attack on the Democratic base and the ability of the Democratic base to mobilize.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, how would a liberal feel if there was a government program giving money to, well, say that there are government programs that give money to, say, Catholic Charities.
Yep.
How would they feel if Catholic Charities started intervening in electoral politics in the way that Planned Parenthood does?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's Planned Parenthood has a separate political arm, which they're allowed to do.
Right.
So it's, you know, there's nothing illegal or untoward about that. And I think that people do have issues with Catholic charities getting government funding.
Yeah, I do too.
Because they think that government shouldn't fund religious organizations.
Which is the same argument that conservatives would make that say, well, Planned Parenthood funds services I don't agree with.
But it's not I don't agree with. It's that the Constitution says that the government shouldn't endorse a particular religion.
Right, but it's still a political issue in a democracy. So it's still subject to...
It's not a question of agreeing or disagreeing with Catholicism, you know. So I think if you disagree that the government, if you agree that the government should not fund faith-based organizations, then you'd say, well, I don't want them giving money to Catholic services, and I don't want them giving money to the American Muslim charity XYZ, and I don't want them giving money to Jewish social services.
Right.
You know, it's all across the board because it's a religious thing. But I think that, you know, decades ago, during the Nixon administration, there was a public policy decision that you know, family, there was a societal good resulting from funding of family planning services. And I think that that is being relitigated now by the religious right.
Well, it's also, but the thing is, where the similarity comes into is that, you know, the funding that goes to Catholic charities or to other religious organizations, you know, they'll say, oh, it's earmarked for services. So this isn't being used for evangelism or something like that. The way that Planned Parenthood says, oh, this money isn't used for abortion.
But exactly. And so the money that Planned Parenthood gets from the federal government can't be used for abortion because of the Hyde Amendment, right? And so they separate that money that they get from the federal government and use it only for non-abortion related things. Well, Catholic services say they also separate the money.
Right.
You know, and don't use it for evangelizing. We're singling out Catholic charities, but, you know, this applies to other religious organizations too. So, you know, so we're expected to, you know, trust that, and we do trust that, right?
Right. But okay.
Okay, so you're equally across the board. You're wondering about this fungibility issue.
Yeah, it's fungible.
But equally, you know, for Planned Parenthood and Catholic charities.
There's only so much money you can raise privately on letterhead that says Catholic Charities or that says Planned Parenthood. And so every dollar you get from the federal government does offset the cost. So then you can use the money that you can raise privately for the other services.
But most women who get abortions at Planned Parenthood are paying for it out of their own pocket, or it's covered by their insurance. And oftentimes when a woman who can't afford an abortion gets it at Planned Parenthood, they get funding from, you know, national abortion funds. There are organizations that raise money to help women who can't afford it obtain an abortion. So there is you know, a separation, and there is, you know, like HHS regulations that require them to, you know, keep a separate accounting. Although I guess Joe Manchin, in his effort to win back his pro-life credentials with the organizations that are angry at him over his no vote on the Planned Parenthood defunding, has drafted legislation that would require even more accounting and accountability for Planned Parenthood keeping the Title X funds separate.
Right. What did you think of the – I was curious about this because one of the things was when, you know, John Kyle came out and made this not factual statement.
Right. But it wasn't intended to be a factual
statement. Right, about how much Planned Parenthood does with abortion. And then there was a pie chart released that was circulating around the web of, you know, saying that you know, abortion services are only 3% of what Planned Parenthood mm-hmm. does. What did you think of that chart? Because I'm curious, because on one level it seemed to say, like, hey, abortion is such a tiny part that it's no big deal. But does that also play into the, you know, criticism that, you know, maybe I felt like it was kind of shamefaced. I thought it was a dishonest pie chart, but
well, who made the pie chart? It is true that 3% of their – or I didn't see the pie chart in particular, okay. But the 3% number I'm familiar with.
Right. Well, but the thing is, what counts as a service – what counts as a contraception service? You know,
you're saying how do they do that calculation?
Yeah, how do you say 30% of what we do is contraception? Like,
I'm not. To be honest, I don't know how they make that calculation. You know, whether it's like if somebody comes in to be fitted for a diaphragm, that counts as one.
Right.
Versus, you know,
or someone who comes picks up some condoms, like, does that count as a? Because, you know, if you look at, you know, my friend Tim Carney over at the Washington Examiner, he did a pie chart. You know, which is services for pregnant women by Planned Parenthood. And if you just look at abortion procedures, adoption referrals, or other prenatal services, abortion looks like 97% of what Planned Parenthood does. You know, they do a third of all abortions in the country, approximately.
Well, that's in part because, you know, anti-abortion activism has driven a lot of providers out of business.
Right.
You know, I think, I guess, regardless of how you do this calculation, I think that you know, Planned Parenthood's own numbers are the 3%. I don't know if that's based on dollar figures of how much each thing costs or the number of patients coming in. I could definitely find that out. But the bottom line is this, right? The bottom line is that the anti-Planned Parenthood contingent is aiming to deprive Planned Parenthood of the Title X funds solely because Planned Parenthood also provides abortions.
Yep.
Without regard to whether these other services provide something good. Do they not consider these other services good?
Probably not. Well, that's right. The thing is, that's the argument that's used against religious groups receiving money, is that, or it's the argument for them, right, is that they provide services in a community. They're already there providing these services. There's not some other group we can give money to that would provide these valuable services. So we've got to give it to these other groups. And
but I guess someone would say,
but it's a religious group. It's a principled objection. It's over. No federal dollars to it. You know, it's constitutional. And
well,
so,
it is. I mean, to be fair. Okay, so it's not unconstitutional for the government to give money to faith-based organizations. I mean, the Supreme Court has not ruled that unconstitutional.
But some people would like it to rule that it's unconstitutional.
Right, right. But, you know, the Obama administration is in the process right now of drafting regulations that would more directly and specifically monitor what organizations receiving money from the government do to segregate that and to make sure that they're not using federal funds to proselytize to people
right.
or otherwise violate constitutional principles. I actually think that that's a near impossible task considering the number of organizations all over the country that are getting federal funding, and how you're going to actually monitor that
right.
in real terms is a little bit of a mystery to me, but you know, I guess I could be convinced.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what do you, if you're paying for the heat in a building that religious people are in, and someone comes in for a service, whether it's food or whatever, you know, how do you segregate the keeping the heat on versus the posters that go up that say, like, you know, find your faith in Christ, you know, whatever. You can't, and just as the same way you can't totally segregate, you know, what might be, you know, receiving some prenatal service at Planned Parenthood, and then someone then says, okay, well, I've received a service that which can be federally funded. Now I'm going to ask the same person, what about abortion? Is it safe? Is it something that you can do? You know, segregating the money in that way is it's just something we write on an accounting ledger. And it seems like something we just do to make ourselves feel good. It's like one of those.
So would you rather see there no federal funding for family planning services?
Would I rather see it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. No federal funding for that. That'd be great. I mean, in my view.
Let's say that Planned Parenthood did no abortions.
Right.
Hypothetically, would you still oppose Title X funding?
I would be less exercised about it, certainly. Yeah.
Oh.
And
so it's
I
not
think
that
I'm
you
like
oppose
a lot
the federal
of those voters.
It's not that you oppose the federal government funding family planning.
No, I do that, but I would
you
be less
that.
Emotionally invested in defunding
that's
it, which is,
well,
I think, where a lot of other people are, right?
Right, but at least, I mean, I have to say that at least you're being honest with the federal funding to the faith-based organizations, which I think a lot of opponents of Planned Parenthood aren't, you know, they don't see that argument applies also to this, the federal funding of the fungibility, the money fungibility argument applies also to faith-based organizations.
Yeah, no, I think it's a legitimate thing. I mean, I'm not trying to be libertarian. I guess I'm trying to be practical in this as well. And yeah, obviously it affects that.
Well, let's change course a little bit.
Sure.
So one of the things that's fascinating to me about the Planned Parenthood issue is that if you're concerned about abortion, the rate of abortion, you should also be concerned about women and men receiving family planning services so that they prevent unintended pregnancies, which of course then prevents abortions. So that's that's an aspect of the Planned Parenthood argument that I've never really quite grasped. But I'm going to use this as a segue to talk about the Obama administration's ambassador to Malta, his recent resignation. And Doug Kamik, who was the ambassador to Malta until he resigned recently, he was a very prominent Catholic supporter, Catholic pro-life supporter of Obama during the campaign.
Right.
He got a lot of heat from conservatives.
Absolutely.
He was a lawyer in the Reagan administration or the first Bush administration.
Mm-hmm.
And then was a law professor at Pepperdine, a very prominent Catholic conservative legal thinker. And he came out for Obama, was very supportive of Obama during the 2008 campaign.
Right.
And one of the things he cited was what he believed to be Obama's commitment to reducing the number of abortions.
Right.
And what I thought that Kamik never really grappled with was that an obvious part of Obama's game plan with that was having access to family planning services and preventing unintended pregnancies. But I thought that as a Catholic, he never really got into the weeds on that. But in any event, can get your views on that. Let me just, lead up to, so then after Obama got elected, he was, Kamik was made ambassador to Malta, but then there was a recent, State Department Inspector General report, which found that, he was moonlighting, I guess, and, writing papers on abortion and his religious beliefs. And the Inspector General, found that to be, incompatible with his duties as ambassador, and then he resigned.
Right. I thought that was really interesting, right? There are a lot of things. So a lot of the reports mention that one of Kamik's, mandates, I guess, from the president had to do with interreligious dialogue.
Right.
I thought that was really...
Is that a specific Malta thing? I wasn't sure.
Well, it was just really funny because Malta is overwhelmingly Catholic, and so is Doug Kamik. So who's supposed to be talking? I know that, he's helped organize some things with, some Libyan refugees, etc. But that's not interreligious dialogue.
Right.
Malta is this beautiful little Mediterranean, Catholic paradise that, is almost... in a way, still enjoying the Catholic Renaissance from 500 years ago. It is so. I find the whole thing kind of funny because it just seems like the report was upset that essentially State Department officials have to go over and edit, little articles that Kamik writes for America Magazine, which is a magazine run by the Jesuits in the United States. They're writing, editing his articles about his father. And, I just find it an odd story.
I read some conservative bloggers were sort of intimating that Obama used Kamik during the campaign.
Yeah.
And sort of became, but I think that, the Inspector General is sort of, supposed to be a non-political thing and supposed to keep keep the individual departments honest. And, it seemed hard to imagine for me that in the middle of this whole Planned Parenthood debate that Obama would decide that for political reasons he wanted to get rid of Doug Kamik. That just didn't...
No, that would make no sense at all.
It makes no political sense. So it's clear that there was some issue within the State Department about whether it was appropriate for the ambassador to be... writing articles of this nature and so
right.
forth.
And the LA Times kind of had an unnamed source close to the scene, translation Doug Kamik, I think. But, an unnamed source that was saying that, this was this dates back to the 80s and some rivalry when Kamik was in the Reagan administration, and it's the same people kind of going after him now. I mean, it'll be funny, though, when the media still follows Kamik in a year and asks him who he's endorsing for president.
Right.
So that'll be a fun one-day story cycle. And it's all going to depend. If the GOP nominates, a Tim Pawlenty or Mitt Romney, I bet you $100 right now that he gets the Kamik endorsement. if the GOP nominates like a Sarah Palin or a analogous figure, I bet you Kamik just stays out of it.
Yeah.
Those, I think those are the only two things. So for all of you out there in Blogging Heads land waiting for the Doug Kamik endorsement in 2012, wait no more. I just told you. How it's going
to
go.
Okay, so we have the prediction from Michael.
Yeah.
Doug Kamik's all-important endorsement.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry, but I don't think that moved a single vote in 2008. I mean, maybe.
Oh, in 2008? No, I don't think so either. Well, it's interesting, you know, I meant to bring it up when we were talking about Planned Parenthood. There was this Guttmacher Institute report last week on religion and contraceptive use. You know, which showed that, you know, despite evangelical opposition to the Title X funding and despite Catholic opposition to the Title X funding, that, you know, vast majorities of Catholic and evangelical women, married and unmarried, use contraception.
Right.
So.
That was interesting. I mean, and the numbers were so overwhelming, right?
Right.
So it was like 99% of women or 99% of evangelicals have used some form of artificial birth control, or, you know, and that's a euphemism for everything but natural family planning.
Right.
And 98% of Catholic women have used it, have ever used it. That was the thing.
Have ever used it, and then
it wasn't currently. And then the numbers were in the 60s for basically, I think, what, currently or ongoingly using?
Well, you know, it was interesting also to me that in the 15 to 19 year old range, not only the numbers of women who had had sex, religious women who had had sex, you know, evangelical Catholic, and also had used birth control. And so I think that it flies a little bit in the face of what the leadership would like you to believe, that, they're more purity-oriented view of how women should behave, mm-hmm. is not how the majority of women in their religious cohort actually do behave.
Right. Well, that's interesting. I wanted to put on this, because some people talk about this issue in terms of the Catholic bishop's policy against birth control.
Right.
Would people describe it as a policy against
It's not lying? A policy. It's a religious teaching.
Would you call it that the Catholic bishops have a policy against lying? Or a policy against breaking the seventh commandment. I mean, I have so many reactions to this, in a way, as someone who does think, and I am a Catholic, believe the Catholic teaching that the use of artificial birth control is immoral. And yet I also, and so the fact that it's not a norm doesn't totally shock me at all. The numbers seem a little higher than I thought they would be, but again, I'm not shocked. On the one hand, I want to say, you know, how many people believe that lying and deception is wrong?
Yet they do it.
And how many people have done it? Yeah.
And sex is way more fun than lying.
I've told some pretty great lies. I'm waiting for the comment section to say that Michael Doherty's had some pretty bad sex. If he but no, I've told some great lies in my time. Now,
what do you feel guiltier about, sex or lying?
I'm a Catholic. You know what the answer is. So that's on one hand, it doesn't surprise me. And two, what I think is interesting is I almost want to flip this around on people supporting Title X funding and say, well, if this is such a norm, even among the people who supposedly would be against this, why do we need federal funding for it?
I mean, oh, because women can't afford it.
Really?
And that's where Planned Parenthood is where they go to get it. And so if they didn't have Planned Parenthood to go get it, they wouldn't have it. They would have unprotected sex. They would get sexually transmitted diseases. They would get pregnant. They would have abortions. They would have back alley abortions if the religious right had its way, and women would die.
Right.
So that's why.
Right. Okay. Well, that's what you say. I think if you're saying something is such a norm and the only way, but yet the only way it survives is by government subsidy, I find that.
I don't think that that's the only way. Obviously, like, women go to private doctors to get contraception. They can go to the drugstore to buy
their insurance sometimes covers it.
But a lot of women use I think that the number is something like, you know, Title X funding helped prevent, in 2008, helped prevent almost a million unplanned pregnancies. So it really does, you know, it is for a lot of women, their access to reliable birth control.
Right. I mean, the other thing is, you know, my other reaction to the story of how many women use a contraception is, well, duh, the sexual revolution happened. I mean,
even for evangelicals and Catholics.
Yeah, it's happened. And also, you know, the Guttmacher survey did use a little distinction between, you know, Catholics who attend church once a month or more or less than that, et cetera. So, you know, it's very funny how these polls have to define
who's really the religious.
Who is religious. So, you know, I could come up with a bunch of sniff tests, like, you know, does this person also attend a weekly Bible study, or do they attend this or that? Mm-hmm. And you would find different numbers.
Yes.
And it's also,
I agree. I agree that church attendance should not be the measurement.
Right. And also, you know, it's a funny thing. I would say also that, you know, I guess my own, you know, I'll let my own personal prejudice fly. I do think if I were a fire and brimstone priest or a pastor, I would bring these numbers out into the congregation and say, you know, well, what is your commitment to living, you know, chastely or something like that? I mean, this should be.
I think they are upset about it.
Yeah.
I think that there was another survey before the Guttmacher one came out. That I saw some folks at Focus on the Family talking about, that they were upset about it because it showed these high numbers of evangelical women having sex outside of marriage or having sex before marriage.
Right.
I mean, to imply that it was extramarital. But that's probably true too.
That's the thing is, you know, the sexual revolution has not, you know, it's like,
it happened.
Yeah. It's an environmental thing where it just, no one's been left unaffected. And
I think people, even before the sexual revolution, people were having sex outside of marriage.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right too.
But I think that the leadership of the religious right would like to sort of relitigate the sexual revolution in spite of the fact that the people in its own pews or, you know, so to speak, are living it.
Right.
You know,
well, so that's like the great, I mean, but that's also the great, you know, you could frame that as religions have a kind of moral duty to call the culture to something better. Right. And sometimes,
yeah, but what if the culture doesn't think that that's better?
Oh, that, I mean, well then it's a struggle. I mean,
it's also who's defining better.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, 'cause you saw things like, you know, you gradually, you know, medieval history major that I am, I mean, gradually the practice of human slavery faded out in Europe throughout the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and onward. But then as colonialism became a phenomenon, it came right back up again. And a lot of churches, Protestant and Catholic, caved or became silent on that issue or whatever, and it just became the norm. And then it took centuries to reverse that norm and you know, and
but,
so
yeah, well that, I mean, you're just using that as an example of how things
over centuries
as opposed to equating sex with slavery.
Right. No, I don't mean to equate that. I mean, I just mean moral issues that the church speaks out on or whatever. But you can have and also, I mean, if you look.
But do you think that the Catholic Church even has the moral authority to tell people what to do with their sex lives in light of the sex abuse scandals?
It's funny you should ask.
Yes. Well, maybe we can use that to talk about the last topic that we were going to talk about.
Yeah. Okay. So
canonization of Pope John Paul II.
Right. John Paul II, our former pope, a current dead person, is set to be canonized. I hope that didn't offend you, but he's said to be beatified, so he would be called Blessed John Paul II, and that's the first step on the way to be calling him Saint John Paul II. And this has a number of theological implications for Catholics. It, you know, would mean that he's a worthy mediator, that you could pray to him in the sense of, you know, ask him for prayers in heaven, etc. And it would also mean, you know, that the Catholic Church is saying, to use the technical term, that his cultus is worthy of universal adoration.
And this is not an automatic thing for popes.
No, 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 not at all. Yeah, I mean, not that Dante's speaks for the whole Catholic Church, but Dante put a few popes in hell. And I'm sure there's more than he put in there. Now, one way of looking at the sainthood issues, when you're saying that someone and their cultus is worthy of universal admiration, it means that you should imitate their life, or that you their life would be one worth imitating. And in many ways, I think that is true of John Paul II. I do think what evidence we have shows that he was personally a very pious Catholic. However, and he's also personally beloved by millions of Catholics still. However, I see a serious problem with raising him to the rafters in the way that the Catholic Church is about to do.
Because
one, he was made pope, and part of being pope is governing the Catholic Church. This is not something that John Paul II did well, or arguably at all. He traveled while Rome burned. Now, I could probably name 100 bishops that would have been much worse than John Paul II. That's not a compliment.
And Rome was burning because
of the sex scandal. One, because mm-hmm. of the sex scandal. John Paul II was a terrible judge of character, or left in place a curia that was a terrible judge of character for promoting bishops to be cardinals or bishops to reign over certain things. You know.
So you're saying that it was under John Paul's papacy that a lot of the bishops and cardinals were moved around, or the priests were moved around to different parishes or dioceses.
Right, and John Paul II never seemed to take this seriously. Now, by the time it became a media event, you know, there are questions whether John Paul II really had it in him to govern, just because of the advanced Parkinson's, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew about this much earlier in his papacy. This was bubbling up. He was also an enabler of Marcial, the head of the Legion of Christ.
Right.
And approved of him, had people in his curia protect Marcial from criticism, and approved, in a sense, pre-approved the charism, you know, the character of Marcial's project, the Legion of Christ. And there are good reasons and to not approve of that character, even before we find out that Marcial had a wife and secret family, that he was stealing his the money of good people that were giving it to him to provide a lifestyle for himself and his mistress and children. There are good reasons to oppose that, because it institutionalized a cult of personality around Marcial that is not compatible with, you know, Catholic notions of obedience.
Right.
And the other thing is just the continuing, or two other things, the continuing degeneration of the Catholic Church as a whole under John Paul II's papacy, in discipline, etc. You know, now this might get some real disagreement from people, but John Paul II would say that something was an abuse of Catholic worship, like, say, the introduction of altar girls. It's an abuse. And 2 years later, the practice was still prevalent, and then suddenly it would become approved. John Paul II also revised the rosary, a beloved prayer of Catholics, adding 5 new decades to the rosary. There are a lot of Catholics that believe that the rosary that was given to St. Dominic in the 12th century was just fine. And also, John Paul II was pope during a time when there was an easily preventable schism with the Society of St. Pius X. So I think for all of these reasons, the push to canonize John Paul II should at least be slowed down. It's moving at a very quick pace. One other thing he did, which was not good and which helps make this process faster, is he eliminated the office of devil's advocate, which is an office that's appointed
within the Vatican.
Right, where that you literally there's a someone making the case against the sainthood of a particular Catholic believer.
Do you think he did that with an eye towards himself becoming a saint?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think he did it partially because there were so many martyrs for the Christian faith in the 20th century that he wanted to speed up the canonization process for a lot of them.
So it's interesting because it sort of seems like there's sort of a two-pronged issue that you have. One is the treatment, the reaction to, or slow reaction to, or lack of reaction to, or bad reaction to the sex abuse scandal. And then other disputes that you have more to do with him altering the traditionalism of a lot of Catholic practices or Vatican hierarchy or Vatican, what would you call them, offices or...
Right. I think people have to look on John Paul II's papacy. There have been popes that have been holy men, but cannot govern the church. I mean, I think of the papacy of Celestine V, who basically boarded himself in a cell within the Vatican Palace.
Okay, you just clearly exceeded my knowledge of Catholic.
Okay, it's just a medieval pope who his sincere wish was to be a hermetic monk, and literally he had no idea how to govern the church.
Right.
And he literally boarded himself up in like a wooden cell within the Vatican Palace and became impossible to deal with. And he eventually resigned. And I think John Paul II is in many ways, an admirable figure. But I think when you look at his papacy, it looks worse and worse every year because you see here he was, this celebrity pope. Yeah. I think the first celebrity pope, mm-hmm. Amazingly charismatic on television, on a stage. I mean, he always was an actor that he began in as Poland, as a young Polish man. However, your job as Pope isn't just to be inspiring. Your job in Pope is also to lead the flock. Mm-hmm. And I think in serious ways, both in faith and morals, he showed, parts of his papacy were not worthy of emulation. And he showed himself to be a fantastically bad judge of character. Now, I'm willing to concede that the clergy and the bishops of the Catholic Church, that they're slim pickings for great leadership. But surely he could have done better than he did. And Catholics are paying for it, and Pope Benedict XVI is paying for it in trying to cope with all the abuse scandals and with the difficulty of mending a schism. So for all those reasons, here's one very conservative Catholic who says, stop.
Okay, well, so I guess that concludes our Holy Week blogging.
Yes, well, you should have a lovely Passover.
Thank you. And I hope you have a lovely Holy Week and Easter.
I will.
And we'll talk next time.
All right, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.